Today's installment of our series is entitled, We All Need a Timothy. Now, I don't know if you would call it a fairy tale romance, but nonetheless, romance bloomed in a traveling circus. The bearded lady and the circus strongman fell in love and got married. Soon enough, the bearded lady discovered that she was pregnant, and the entire circus community was overjoyed by the impending birth. One day, the owner of the circus, who was also the ringmaster, stopped by to inquire how the bearded lady was doing with her pregnancy. "How are you feeling?" he asked. "Oh, very well," she replied. "I was wondering," the ringmaster continued, "do you care if the baby is a boy or a girl?" "Oh, not at all," the future mother replied. "All we care is that the baby is healthy and can fit into a cannon." I guess the couple had hopes that their child would follow them into the family business. And many of us feel the same way about our careers or our businesses. We hope that someone will follow in our footsteps. But hoping this will happen and making it happen are two very different things. And this brings us to the focus of our subject today as we examine relationships in our lives as originally outlined in Leonard Sweet's book, 11 Indispensable Relationships You Cannot Do Without. Today, we hopefully will see the importance and the value of having a Timothy in our lives. Yes, we are using the Timothy in the New Testament as the template for today's subject. A Timothy, in this case, is a protege, an heir, an apprentice, someone who's younger or maybe even less mature than ourselves. Usually that's the case, but there is an interesting movie about those who are our protégés called The Intern, starring Robert De Niro, who is an older man, and it's quite an interesting film. A Timothy is someone who learns over time to know your ways and your thinking better than most other people. And maybe they learn more than what we are particularly comfortable with. Now, the historical Timothy, the one in the scriptures, was raised by a single parent, his mother, and by his grandmother. And both of these women were very devout. At the time Timothy joins Paul in his missionary journeys, it is believed that he was probably around the age of 16 years. Paul had a great fondness for Timothy. He even refers to him as his son. It is the same term of endearment that Peter uses for his protege, Jean-Marc. Timothy was a keen learner and a hard worker, which aided in his development as a missionary. A Timothy is different than just a pupil or someone to supervise. The relationship we're talking about here is much deeper than a teacher and student. And when the relationship works, it is a life-enriching thing. The idea about having a Timothy in our lives raises a question before us today. Will you have any heirs? Do you have someone who will inherit your work and your legacy? Will you have an heir not just of your possessions, but rather, more importantly, of your life and your soul? Now, we all know from stories and experience that finding heirs for our money and our possessions, well, that's got to be one of the easiest things in life to do. We all know when it comes to estates and settling things, there arises family feuds. And there's an old expression that I really love that says, where there's a will, there's a relative. But does anyone actually clamor to take over your service to God? Who takes over the family business? I mean, God's family business. Alan Jameson writes about it this way. Like Abram, the question that we too must consider is whether we will have descendants. Not children in our own line, but descendants in our faith and in our life. Will we love and care for others in such a way that they will become our descendants? People to whom and through whom the lessons of faith we have learned are passed on, and the richness of our experience of God's presence and even our sense of God's absence on occasion is carried. As I contemplated Jameson's words, in the back of my mind there arose a rather unsettling thought. I've wondered for a long time about the decline of interest and participation in churches, and I'm wondering if that can be directly connected to the fact that too many Christians for too long are not cultivating relationships with their Timothys. For too long, we thought our children would simply just come with us to church and just soak up the faith by exposure. Drag them to church long enough, we thought, and they'll just stick to it like glue. The problem is that many children and teens grow up coming to church, but never really knowing why. Why do mom and dad commit to this worship service every week? Just because we are faithfully bringing them to church doesn't mean they know what it means to walk the Christian walk. Keith Green many years ago said in one of his songs, "Going to church doesn't make you a Christian any more than going to McDonald's makes you a hamburger." One of the saddest demonstrations of inadequacy of depending on familial ties to help our children take up the faith comes from way back in the Old Testament in 1 Samuel. Eli was a very devout man. He was the high priest of the tabernacle. And because he was of the tribe of Levi, he was the one entrusted with the services of worship there. Now, Eli's sons were being groomed by Eli to take over from him. But in 1 Samuel chapter 2, we read that Eli's sons were very wicked. They were known to have stolen from the sacrifices. They actually took advantage of women who were coming to worship. These guys were bad news all around. And Eli is reported to have pleaded with them to change from their wicked ways, but they continually refused. Verse 25 of that chapter is one of the scariest in Scripture. It says, "But Eli's sons wouldn't listen to their father, for the Lord had already planned to put them to death." Eli's true protege, his heir, was not his own flesh and blood, but the young prophet Samuel. Paul himself was a Timothy. He had a protege in his early years. We might remember that Paul was apprenticed to Gamaliel, perhaps the most important rabbi of his day. Gamaliel was bestowed the name Rabboni, which means overteacher. The implication was that he was a teacher of teachers. This guy knew his stuff. But we also know that he was also a protege to his father Hillel, who is considered one of the most important historic interpreters of the Torah. One interesting story from the book of Acts has Gamaliel counseling patience to Saul and the rest of the Sanhedrin who were bent on stoning the followers of Jesus. His relationship to Timothy was very valuable to Paul. Have you noticed that when Paul begins many of his letters, he writes that he sends greetings from himself and from Timothy? The reality is, Paul knew that if the church was to survive beyond him and to thrive, there would need to be a whole new generation of leaders. I think there's some truth of something I heard a church leader once say, in that a church, or church in general, is only one generation away from oblivion. Meaning we must always be prepared to help the next generation become kingdom builders. Every great leader, every great teacher has at some point a Timothy in their lives, a protege, And the Bible's full of examples of that. One of the more interesting ones from the Old Testament was that Elisha was apprenticed to Elijah. Joshua was apprenticed to Moses. But interestingly enough, Joshua didn't have a protege. He didn't have a Timothy in his life. And the consequences to Israel were tragic. When Joshua dies, and there's no heir to leadership, the people of Israel entered the time of the judges. If you read that book, you realize that the time of the judges was a time marked by brutality and violence without equal. In our more modern history, we can examine the life of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, whose political career ended in 2006 when he had a massive stroke. When he was the Israeli Defense Minister and also the Agriculture Minister, he undertook to build Jewish settlements in the occupied territories and to mercilessly defeat Israel's enemies. To some, namely the Israeli people, he was a hero. But to others, like Yasser Arafat of the PLO, he was a war criminal. In one of the world's biggest surprises, one of history's biggest surprises, when Sharon became prime minister, he made an abrupt turnaround, which surprised everyone. He undertook to create peace with his Arab neighbors, including the Palestinians. He went so far as to begin to demolish the settlements he had originally ordered built. And when asked about the change of heart, Sharon said, "You see things from here that you didn't see from there." With incredible courage, he admitted that he was wrong. And Sharon began to clean up the mess he had made, going so far as to even leave his own political party, who refused to follow his lead. Just as he was making considerable progress in the peace process, his stroke ended his career, and he had no protege to step up. And history has shown us that Israel was once more thrown into chaos. The need for Timothy in our lives is not about getting help for projects, although that's one of the benefits. But sometimes the work we are called to cannot be accomplished in our lifetime. Much like those cathedrals all over Europe that took many decades to build, we need Timothys to wield the hammer to lay the stone after we are no longer able to carry on. Otherwise, the work that we undertook can remain unfinished and will ultimately degrade over time. For the relationship with a Timothy to work well, an investment of time and presence is needed. Now, I should point out that Timothy was not the only protege that Paul had. He had Titus, Epaphroditus, Silas, and Luke, and maybe others that we don't know about. In each case, Paul invited them to travel with him, to watch what he did, and to learn the message of the gospel that he was sharing. Sometimes we read that he actually gave them assignments to see how they were going or how they were developing. At all times, these protégés carried Paul's authority and his name. Have you noticed a pattern in the Bible when God calls and sends people? Most often, God sends his servants out in pairs or in groups. Not always, but quite often. We read that Jesus sent out 70 disciples in pairs. Paul rarely traveled alone. The work of God's kingdom seems more vibrant, more dynamic as a collaborative effort with partners and traveling companions. Unfortunately, the current model of churches is for a lone wolf pastor encouraging lone wolf parishioners. The corporate world has realized the folly of this and have moved away from it because of new leading-edge technology. The isolated cubicle desks are now eliminated, and now there's open areas to encourage collaboration and creativity to discourage possessiveness. I need to be clear here in stating that I'm not talking about making clones of ourselves. That's very important. Joshua was not like Moses. Timothy was not a clone of Paul. Our Timothys are unique individuals. They have a different history than we do. They have had and will have a different experience of God. They will have different skills, interests, and more importantly, a different voice. When I say voice, I'm not referring to the tone or whether someone's a tenor or a soprano. I'm talking about the protege's ability to speak for themselves, to contribute to the work of God in their own unique way. As a pastor over the years, I've had occasion to supervise new pastors who are just starting out in their ministry. Actually, Elaine was one of the former pastors I was asked to supervise in this church. It is natural for many of these pastors to ask me a simple questions about, well, how do you do this and how do you do that? And especially, how do you prepare sermons? The task that is most challenging, even for the more experienced pastors, especially when you got to do it week in and week out with a time crunch. One of the things I stress with each one of them that I've worked with is that they must find their own style. They must find their own voice. Now, it's a valuable thing to listen to and study other more experienced preachers, but to be truly effective, you must embrace the uniqueness that is God-given in each one of us. Now, to be fair, finding your voice takes time. Lots of stumbles along the way, but all of us, whatever capacity we serve the kingdom, we have to find our voice. This is essential for preaching, but it's also essential to the whole picture of ministry. How I prepare for Sunday, how I craft sentences, how the Bible speaks to me, how God speaks to me is unique to me and unique for each one of you. For someone else to come along and try and replicate what I'm doing or who I am is foolishness. They are not me. Nor are they being called to be like me. And that is a very, very good thing. You know, people like to say that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. No, it's not. Not at all. No greater compliment can be given to us than when the next generation we have been mentoring in the faith steps up and takes the reins, but in a different, imaginative way. Like in August 1953 when a truck driver arrived in a Memphis recording studio and announced that he wanted to begin his singing career. Well, the secretary at the desk asked, "What do you sound like?" The truck driver responded, "I don't sound like nobody." And that was Elvis Presley. One of the greatest harms we inflict on our proteges is misleading them into thinking also that more means better. Our postmodern culture, we are at every turn being told that more is better. Now, this is especially true with technology. More is better means doing what we've been doing, but do it bigger, faster, with added value. More is better is a profit-generating juggernaut. Just think about how many iPhones there's been. I think we're up to 10 now. Convincing our Timothys and ourselves that more is better by stressing more folks in the pews, more technology in worship, more focus on mass marketing means the ministry is simply spinning its wheels. Robert Venturi was a noted architect, quoted as saying, more is a bore. More has given us mega churches, they've given us Microsoft, all kinds of spiritual inventory tests. This is not a bad thing, but it stunts us. What we need to instill in our Timothys and also within ourselves is that more can also mean different. Leonard Sweet writes that in the King James Version of the Bible and the Revised Standard and also in the NIV, the Bible often translates the Greek word as more. Other translations actually offer a word much closer to the truth. They translate the word more as out of the ordinary, unusual, remarkable. I truly believe that more as different is what Jesus had in mind when he talked about abundant living. A lack of appreciation and cultivation of imagination is why Timothy's quit. They are looking, they're longing for more as different. But far too often we pause, we stifle the imagination. We demand our Timothys worship as we did, that they minister as we did. Lord Alfred Douglas belongs to a very exclusive club. Mark Twain is actually another famous member. Lord Douglas had the rare opportunity to read his own obituary. Taking the February 4th, 1921 edition of the Evening News, Douglas was halted by the following headline: Sudden Death of Lord Alfred Douglas Found Dead in Bed by a Maid. And if that wasn't bad enough, what followed was even worse. It read of him, "A brilliant and unhappy career is ended. The charity which is fitting at all times, but most fitting when we're speaking of the newly dead, urges that much should be forgiven this poor, bewildered man, who with all his gifts will perhaps be remembered by the scandals and the quarrels with which he involved himself." Douglas, who was 51 at the time, read that and he was furious. We would be too, perhaps. He sued the paper for defamation, and he claimed the obituary actually left out significant aspects of his life. He wondered, where is the my love of poetry and my horsemanship, my fame? Now, Douglas won the lawsuit, but history has proven that the obituary was actually correct. If your obituary were written today, what would it say? What legacy have you passed on? And to whom? Who is your Timothy to pick up your baton?